From Intellijix, this is Intellijix True Crime. Today, three true cases, each one investigated, tried, and closed. Let's begin. It was the kind of neighborhood where people left their garage doors open on Saturday afternoons, where kids rode bikes to the corner store, where nobody locked the back door until well after dark. San Diego, California, in the autumn of 1994. Sun warmed and ordinary. The kind of place where a man might reasonably believe that no one would look too closely, that a story told with just enough grief and just enough detail would be accepted at face value, and that a life could be quietly erased and just as quietly explained away. Michael Peterson called 911 on a morning that felt, to responding officers, like a dozen other domestic disturbance calls they had fielded that year. His voice carried the recognizable architecture of shock, halting, then rushing forward, then halting again. He told the dispatcher that he had come home and found his wife, that something had happened, that she wasn't moving. By the time patrol units pulled up to the Peterson residence, the scene inside was already waiting for them, arranged, as investigators would later come to believe, with a particular purpose in mind. Carol Peterson was 38 years old, and by every documented account, she was a woman who moved through the world with a kind of uncomplicated warmth that people tend to remember long after they've forgotten the details of how they knew someone. Friends who spoke to reporters and later to investigators described her as fiercely loyal, the kind of friend who showed up, who called back, who remembered the birthdays that other people let slip. She had worked steadily, maintained a circle of close relationships, and by all appearances had poured genuine energy into the life she shared with Michael Peterson. They had been married for several years. Neighbors recalled them as a couple that seemed, from the outside, to function well, cordial at block gatherings, unremarkable in the way that people mean when they say unremarkable as a compliment, as a form of stability. What was happening inside that house, prosecutors would later argue, was something altogether different from the picture presented to the world. There were, according to court records and subsequent trial testimony, signs that the marriage had deteriorated in ways that Carol's closest friends were only beginning to understand. Financial pressures, tensions that had begun to surface. But Carol Peterson, by the accounts of those who loved her, was not a woman who broadcast her difficulties. She kept them close. She managed. She was, in the particular way of people who are deeply private about their pain, still very much living her life, still making plans, still present in the lives of the people who cared about her, right up until the morning she wasn't. The shot that killed Carol Peterson was fired inside the couple's home. She died of a gunshot wound, and the manner of her death was not, in itself, the mystery. What became the question? The question that investigators would spend months methodically unraveling was the question of by whose hand and toward what end. Michael Peterson's account, as he gave it to the first officers on scene, and as it would be elaborated upon in subsequent interviews, was that he had returned home to find signs of a break-in, that an intruder must have entered the residence, and that Carol had died in circumstances connected to that intrusion. It was, in its broad strokes, a scenario that investigators recognized immediately. The staging of a burglary, the manufacturing of disorder intended to suggest a stranger's violence where something far more intimate had occurred. They had seen it before. They knew what it looked like. And almost from the first hour, according to case records and investigative reporting on the case, they were skeptical. The inconsistencies began to accumulate before the morning was over. The physical evidence at the scene, detectives noted, did not match the story Peterson had offered. Items that might reasonably have been disturbed in a genuine burglary were displaced in ways that felt, to trained eyes, deliberate rather than incidental, moved, rather than knocked aside. There were things that should have been taken, had a burglar truly been present, that had not been taken. And there were aspects of Carol's position, of the wound itself, of the spatial relationships between where she lay and where the shot had come from, that began to point quietly, then with increasing force, in a direction that had nothing to do with a stranger passing through. Forensic analysis became the spine of the investigation. San Diego law enforcement brought in specialists to examine the trajectory of the fatal shot, the distribution of physical evidence in the room, and the question of where, precisely, a person would have had to be standing in order to fire it. What those analysts found, and what prosecutors would later argue to a jury with documented forensic testimony, was that the geometry of the scene was incompatible with Peterson's account of an unknown intruder. The angle, the distance, the particulars of how the shot had been fired, all of it, investigators concluded, placed the shooter in a position and in a relationship to Carol Peterson that suggested someone known to her, someone inside that home not as an intruder but as a resident, as a husband. There was also the matter of the gun. The investigation traced the firearm with the methodical patience that serious homicide investigations require. And what emerged from that process, according to court records, was evidence connecting the weapon to Michael Peterson in ways that further undermined the narrative he had constructed. Prosecutors argued that the totality of the forensic picture, the trajectory analysis, the physical staging, the weapon's provenance, the absence of any credible evidence of a third party, pointed conclusively to Peterson as the person who had shot and killed his wife. He was arrested, and with his arrest came the slower, more deliberate work of assembling a case that could be presented to a jury. Not simply a collection of forensic observations, but a coherent narrative of motive, opportunity, and intent that would allow 12 ordinary people to understand not just what had happened, but why. Motive, in cases like this one, is always the most human and therefore the most difficult piece of the puzzle. Prosecutors in the Peterson case pointed to the state of the marriage, to the financial circumstances the couple had been navigating, and to what they characterized as a relationship that had reached a point of crisis. They argued that Michael Peterson had made a calculation, that he saw in Carol's death not a tragedy but a solution, and that he had planned and carried out that solution with enough deliberateness to then attempt to cover his tracks with a staged scene. These were the arguments made by the prosecution and documented in trial records. Peterson maintained his innocence. The trial unfolded in 1995, and it was, in the way of trials that hinge on forensic evidence, a contest between competing interpretations of physical fact. The prosecution's forensic witnesses testified with precision about trajectory and positioning, and what the evidence in their expert judgment established. The defense challenged those conclusions, argued for alternative readings of the evidence, and insisted that the investigation had been conducted with a predetermined conclusion in mind. It was, in the courtroom, a sustained and serious dispute, the kind of thing that can feel, to observers, like it might go either way, right up until it doesn't. The jury found Michael Peterson guilty of first-degree murder. That finding, not an allegation, but the adjudicated conclusion of 12 jurors who had heard weeks of testimony and examined the evidence presented to them, established that Carol Peterson had been killed intentionally, with premeditation, by her husband. The verdict carried with it the weight of what the jury believed had been taken, not just a life, but a life that had been planned to end, that had been treated as a problem to be solved. At sentencing, the judge imposed a term of life in prison without the possibility of parole. Michael Peterson would not be returning to the San Diego neighborhood where he had called 911 on that autumn morning. He would not be reconstructing a life on the other side of a prison term. The sentence was, by design, permanent, a legal recognition that what had been done to Carol Peterson placed her killer beyond the reach of the kind of second chances that the parole system is built around. Peterson appealed his conviction, as is both his right and the ordinary course of a case of this magnitude. The appellate process is not a formality. It is a genuine and important mechanism for reviewing whether a trial was conducted fairly, whether the evidence was properly admitted, whether the jury was properly instructed. In Peterson's case, That process ran its course through the California appellate system, and the conviction was upheld. The reviewing courts found no reversible error in the trial proceedings sufficient to overturn the jury's verdict. The finding of guilt stood. The sentence stood. As of the available record, Michael Peterson remains in California State Prison, serving that life sentence. There is something that happens in the aftermath of cases like this one that doesn't make it into the court documents and doesn't appear in the forensic reports. It happens in the quieter spaces, in the lives of the people who knew Carol Peterson, who had Saturday afternoon plans with her, who expected to hear her voice on the phone, who are now left with the particular grief of a loss that was not accidental, not random, not the kind of thing that could be attributed to the indifferent machinery of illness or fate. Carol Peterson was 38 years old. She was killed by the person who was supposed to be her partner, in the home they shared, in a city that felt safe, in a neighborhood where people left their garage doors open. The staging of a crime scene is, in some respects, the most telling detail of cases like this one, not because of what it reveals about the mechanics of the crime, but because of what it reveals about the relationship between a killer and the truth. To stage a scene is to make a calculation about what other people will believe, to bet that the story you construct will be more powerful than the story the evidence is telling. It is a particular kind of contempt for the investigators who will respond, for the system that will examine the evidence, and most profoundly, for the person whose death is being reframed as a stranger's random act, whose murder is being dressed up as something impersonal and arbitrary. The investigators in this case didn't accept that reframing. They looked at what was in front of them with the trained skepticism that good police work requires, and they kept looking until the evidence told its own story clearly enough that it could be told in a courtroom. It took time, and it took careful work, and it required forensic specialists who were willing to explain, in terms a jury could understand, why the physical facts of a room don't lie even when the person describing them does. Carol Peterson deserved that. She deserved the kind of investigation that treats a woman's life as worth the full weight of the system's attention, that does not accept the convenient explanation when the inconvenient one is true. And in this case, she received it imperfectly, as all human endeavors are imperfect, but genuinely. What remains, beyond the verdict and the sentence and the appellate decisions, is the shape of a life that ended too soon and under circumstances it never should have encountered. Carol Peterson was not a character in a crime story. She was a woman with friends who loved her, with a laugh that people remembered, with a future that stretched forward from 1994 inches ways she would never know. The trial and the conviction and the life sentence are the legal system's accounting for what was taken. They are necessary, and they matter, but they are not the same thing as what was lost. They never are. Our next case takes us to Tillamook County, Oregon. The call came in on a gray Oregon morning, the kind where the Pacific swallows the horizon whole and the sky, and the sea become one indistinguishable thing. Lauren Weston had motored his fishing vessel back into the harbor alone, and when the dock hands asked after his partner, he told them the man had simply gone. Gone over the side, he said, somewhere out there in the deep water off the Tillamook County coast. An accident. A tragedy. The sea takes people sometimes. Everyone who works these waters knows that. But the investigators who would later pick apart every detail of that morning knew something else, too. They knew that the sea, for all its vastness, is not always as cooperative a cover story as people imagine. And they knew that blood, even a little of it, even blood someone has worked hard to clean away, has a habit of telling the truth long after everything else has gone quiet. This is the story of Larry Harmon, a Pacific Northwest fisherman who loved his work and loved his family, and of what prosecutors in Tillamook County, Oregon, ultimately argued was a calculated act of violence carried out against him somewhere beyond the sight of land, on a boat he trusted, by a man he knew. Larry Harmon had spent the better part of his adult life on or near the water. Friends and family who spoke to investigators and reporters in the months after his disappearance described a man who was happiest when the smell of brine was in the air and there was honest work to be done with his hands. He was, by most accounts, a straightforward person, someone who showed up when he said he would, who paid what he owed, who measured his days in practical terms. He had roots along the Oregon coast the way the shore pines do, low and wind-shaped and stubborn against the weather. The commercial fishing life suited him precisely because it demanded that kind of steadiness. You could not be careless out there and expect to survive long, and Larry Harmon was not a careless man. His partnership with Lauren Weston had developed the way many such arrangements do along small coastal communities, through proximity, through shared need, through the practical logic of two men who figured they could do better working together than working apart. They ran offshore fishing operations, the kind of enterprise that requires early mornings and long hours and a tolerance for the physical punishment the North Pacific dishes out without apology. People who knew both men described the partnership as functional, if not always smooth. There were tensions, as there often are when money and livelihood are involved. And investigators would later learn that in the days and weeks leading up to Harmon's disappearance, those tensions had sharpened considerably. Witnesses told law enforcement they had seen the two men arguing. The disagreements, according to court records and regional news coverage of the case, appeared to be rooted in the financial underpinnings of their arrangement, in debts, in obligations, in the particular stress that comes when a shared business is not going as well as either party had hoped. None of that, of course, explains away a man vanishing from a boat. None of it on its own is a crime. But it matters because context is everything in a case like this. Context is the water the facts swim in. The offshore trip that would end Larry Harmon's life, or, at the very least, end the last verified chapter of it, took place in 2003, out in the Pacific waters off Tillamook County. The two men departed together, as they had done many times before. What happened between the moment they left the harbor and the moment Lauren Weston returned alone is something only one of those men could ever fully account for, and the account that Weston offered when he came back would shift in ways that investigators found deeply troubling. Weston's initial explanation for his partner's absence was built around the idea of an accident at sea, the kind of sudden, terrible thing that can happen to anyone working on a vessel in open water. A slip, perhaps, a wave, a moment's inattention. The ocean had taken him. It happens. Except that the details of Weston's account did not stay consistent as investigators began pressing him, and the inconsistencies were not small ones. The timeline wobbled. The specifics of where they had been and what they had been doing and precisely when and how Harmon had gone into the water did not hold their shape under scrutiny. Law enforcement noted, according to court records, that the story changed in ways that could not easily be attributed to the ordinary fog of shock and grief. And then there was the boat. Forensic investigators examined Weston's vessel, and what they found aboard it became the cornerstone of the case against him. The examination revealed the presence of blood evidence. Blood that, according to testimony and court documents from the subsequent prosecution, was inconsistent with Weston's explanation of an accidental fall overboard. The location of the blood, the nature of it, the pattern. These are the details that forensic analysis is designed to interrogate, and the interrogation did not support the story of an accident. Prosecutors would ultimately argue that the blood evidence indicated something far more deliberate had occurred on that boat, something violent, something that had been inadequately cleaned up afterward in the manner of a man who believed the sea would take care of the rest. Bodies lost at sea often are never recovered. That fact is not lost on anyone who lives and works along the coast, and it is a fact that, in the grimly practical calculus of criminal planning, can seem to offer a certain protection. No body, the old legal maxim goes, no crime. But Oregon prosecutors and law enforcement were not prepared to let that logic stand unchallenged. The blood evidence was real. The witness accounts of conflict between the two men were real. The inconsistencies in Weston's account were real. And when taken together, they built something that investigators believed was more than enough to take to a jury. The investigation proceeded with the particular methodical care that cases without a recovered body demand. Detectives with the Tillamook County Sheriff's Office and Oregon State Police worked the case through the latter part of 2003, building the evidentiary record piece by careful piece. They interviewed witnesses who had observed Weston and Harmon together in the days preceding the fishing trip, collecting testimony about the state of their relationship and the nature of the disputes between them. They documented the financial circumstances of the partnership, tracing what prosecutors alleged was a motive rooted in money and the desire to escape obligations that Weston may have felt were closing in around him. The forensic work on the vessel was painstaking. Blood evidence does not always survive the environment of a working fishing boat. The salt water, the cleaning, the ordinary mess of commercial fishing can obscure or complicate biological evidence considerably. But investigators were able to recover and analyze what was there, and the results of that analysis, as presented in court, pointed away from accident and toward something else entirely. The precise details of the forensic findings were laid out in testimony during the trial proceedings, and they formed a significant part of the prosecution's case. Witnesses also came forward to describe what they had seen and heard in the days before the trip. The image that emerged from their accounts was of two men whose partnership had deteriorated, of arguments that had grown more heated, of a situation that felt, in retrospect, like it was building towards something. The charge was significant not only for its severity, but for what it represented. Oregon prosecutors making the argument that the death of a man whose body was never recovered could still be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, that the evidence left behind, on a boat, in the testimony of witnesses, in the contradictions of a survivor's story, was sufficient to establish what, whether any of those witnesses understood at the time what they might be seeing, the approach of a final confrontation, is impossible to say. Hindsight has a way of clarifying things that felt merely uncomfortable in the moment. Lauren Weston was charged with the murder of Larry Harmon, had happened out there on the water. The case went to trial in Tillamook County in 2003 and into 2004, drawing the kind of attention that a small coastal community tends to direct toward matters that strike at the heart of how people there live and work and trust one another. Commercial fishing is not simply an occupation along the Oregon coast. It is a way of life, and the idea that a man could be killed by his partner on a working vessel, killed and disposed of in the water, and then explained away as an accident, that landed with particular weight in the community. Prosecutors laid out their case with the methodical precision the evidence demanded. They walked the jury through the forensic findings from the boat, presenting testimony about the blood evidence and what it indicated about the nature of the events that had taken place aboard the vessel. They presented the witness testimony about the deteriorating relationship between Weston and Harmon, about the arguments, about the financial tensions that investigators argued had provided the motive. They addressed directly the challenge that the defense would inevitably raise, the absence of Larry Harmon's body. They argued that the absence of remains did not mean the absence of a crime. It meant only that a man who committed violence on the open ocean had hoped the sea would keep his secret. Weston's defense, as is standard in such proceedings, challenged the sufficiency of the prosecution's evidence and argued that the case against their client was built on inference and circumstance rather than definitive proof. Without a body, without a direct eyewitness account of the alleged killing, the defense contended that the jury could not be certain enough to convict. It is the argument that must be made in cases like this, and it is not a frivolous one. The standard is beyond reasonable doubt, and that is exactly as it should be. The jury considered the evidence and found it sufficient. Lauren Weston was convicted of the murder of Larry Harmon. The verdict, documented in Oregon court records, reflected the jury's determination that what the prosecution had presented, the forensic evidence, the witness testimony, the demonstrable inconsistencies in Weston's account, added up to proof beyond that required standard. They found him guilty. Weston was sentenced to life imprisonment, a sentence that reflected both the gravity of the crime and Oregon's approach to first-degree murder cases in the applicable period. The sentence meant that a man who had spent his working life on the water would spend the rest of his years confined, as far from the ocean as a prison cell places a person. In the years following the conviction, the case moved through the appeals process in the way that serious criminal convictions in Oregon routinely do. Defendants in murder cases have the right to challenge their convictions on legal grounds, and those challenges represent an essential feature of a functioning justice system rather than an annoyance to it. The record of those appellate proceedings, as documented in Oregon court records, does not reflect a successful challenge to the underlying conviction. Weston's guilty verdict and life sentence stood as the durable legal conclusion of the case. His status, as of the most recent available public record, remains that of a convicted murderer serving a life sentence in Oregon. There is something that deserves to be said about cases like this one, about what it means when a person disappears into the ocean, and the question of what happened to them has to be answered by everything except the most obvious kind of evidence. We tend to think of justice as requiring a body on a table, a cause of death inscribed in a medical examiner's report, a chain of physical evidence that leaves no room for ambiguity. And often, thank goodness, that is what we have. But sometimes the ocean takes what it takes, and the people left behind, the family and friends of Larry Harmon, who never got to bury him, who never got to stand over a grave and say a proper goodbye, are left to grieve a disappearance as much as a death. That particular kind of loss is its own cruelty, layered on top of the cruelty of the crime itself. To not know with certainty where a person is, even when a jury has found beyond reasonable doubt what happened to them, that is a wound that does not close the way other wounds do. What the jury and the court in Tillamook County determined was that Larry Harmon did not die by accident. They determined that he was killed, allegedly by the man who shared his boat and his livelihood and the particular intimacy of long days at sea. The fishing community along the Oregon coast processes that kind of news in the way that small, close-knit communities always do, with grief, with anger, with the slow, uncomfortable renegotiation of trust that follows the discovery that danger was much closer than anyone imagined. Larry Harmon went to sea on a routine day and did not come home. The life he had built, the roots he had sunk along the coast, the work he had done with his hands, the relationships he had maintained with the steadiness that characterized him, none of that was enough to protect him when it mattered most. He deserved better than the end he met, out there somewhere where the gray sky meets the gray water and the land is too far away to see. He deserved the ordinary continuation of an ordinary life. The ocean has not given him back, but the courts at least gave him something. They gave him a verdict. And sometimes, for the people who loved someone lost in exactly this way, a verdict is the closest thing to an answer they will ever hold in their hands. Our next case takes us to Durham, North Carolina. It was just before 2:30 in the morning on December 9, 2001, when the 911 dispatcher in Durham, North Carolina, picked up a call that would consume the next 16 years of American true crime consciousness. The man on the other end of the line was Michael Peterson, a novelist of some local renown, and he was telling the dispatcher that he had come inside from the backyard pool area to find his wife at the bottom of the back staircase of their home. He said she wasn't breathing. He said there was blood. What the paramedics found when they arrived at 1810 Cedar Street, a handsome, sprawling mansion in one of Durham's most coveted neighborhoods, was something that would stop each of them cold. There was, indeed, blood, but the quantity of it and the places it had traveled did not match the story of a woman who had simply fallen. It pooled on the landing. It streaked the walls. It climbed, in patterns that forensic experts would later spend weeks trying to explain to a jury more than 5 feet up the stairwell. The first responders called for investigators, and something that Michael Peterson had framed as a terrible accident began, almost immediately, to be examined as something else entirely. Kathleen Peterson was 48 years old, and by every account of those who knew her, she was formidable in the best possible sense of the word. She had grown up in a military family, the kind of upbringing that instills a certain self-reliance, a certain habit of meeting the world on its own terms and expecting to win. She had built a career in technology management at Nortel Networks that was, by 2001, genuinely impressive. She was a director-level executive navigating a demanding industry at a moment when that industry was changing faster than almost anyone could track. Colleagues described her as whip-smart and warm, capable of command without losing warmth. Friends remembered her laughter. Her daughter, Caitlin, remembered a woman who showed up consistently and fully in the life of her child. Kathleen was also stepmother to Michael's 2 sons from his first marriage and to 2 girls, Margaret and Martha Ratliff, whom Michael had informally adopted after the death of their mother. A woman named Elizabeth Ratliff, who had died years earlier in Germany under circumstances that, in time, would become central to this very story. By the accounts that survive her, Kathleen Peterson moved through her world with energy and intention. She had plans. She was, by all visible measures, building something, a life, a blended family, a future. She did not know, as she and her husband sat outside by the pool on the evening of December 9th sharing wine, that she had only hours left. The timeline that investigators pieced together in the immediate aftermath began with that quiet evening at home. Michael Peterson would tell police that he and Kathleen had spent the night outside, that they had been drinking, that he had perhaps dozed off in his chair, and that when he went inside sometime after midnight, he had found her at the base of the stairs. He called 911 at approximately 2:40 a.m. Emergency personnel noted that Kathleen's body was still warm, but that she had been dead for some time. An observation that would become one of many threads investigators began pulling in the days that followed. The medical examiner, Dr. Deborah Radish, conducted an autopsy that would prove consequential. She identified 7 lacerations on Kathleen's scalp, deep, irregular wounds. She found no skull fractures, no brain injuries consistent with a single catastrophic fall. What she found, prosecutors would later argue, was a pattern consistent with blunt force trauma inflicted repeatedly by a weapon of some kind. Dr. Radish's conclusion, which she would defend at length on the witness stand, was that Kathleen Peterson did not die from an accidental fall. She died, the medical examiner ruled, from homicidal assault. Michael Peterson, meanwhile, was at the center of attention from nearly the first hours. He was a man of public profile in Durham, a former city council candidate, a newspaper columnist, a writer whose military novels had earned him a readership. He was also, investigators quickly learned, a man with a complicated private life. In the weeks following Kathleen's death, authorities discovered email correspondence on the couple's computer that indicated Michael Peterson had been engaged in a relationship with a male escort. Prosecutors would argue at trial that this secret, and the potential for its exposure, provided a window into the tensions of the Peterson marriage that Kathleen's friends and colleagues had not seen from the outside. Financial pressures were also documented. The couple was wealthier in appearance than in reality, and investigators established that Kathleen carried a substantial life insurance policy. None of this, standing alone, was proof of anything. But in the architecture of a circumstantial case, each element became a stone in the foundation. Then came Germany. Among the most arresting developments in the investigation was what detectives uncovered when they looked into the history of Michael Peterson's time stationed in Germany in the 1980s. Elizabeth Ratliff, the mother of Margaret and Martha, the 2 girls Peterson had taken in and raised, had died in November 1985 in the German town of Bad Krotzingen. At the time, her death had been ruled a stroke. She had been found by Michael Peterson at the bottom of a staircase in her home. Peterson had been among the last people to see her alive. When North Carolina prosecutors, having learned of this death, had Elizabeth Ratliff's body exhumed in 2003, a forensic pathologist examined her remains and reached a conclusion that prosecutors seized upon. Her death, they argued, should have been ruled a homicide. The wounds observed on her body, the forensic expert testified, were consistent with blunt force trauma, not a stroke, not a fall. The North Carolina jury would hear this testimony. Two women, two staircases, one man present in both cases. Prosecutors argued the pattern was not coincidence. It was, they said, a signature. Michael Peterson was arrested and charged with first-degree murder in July 2003. His trial, which began that summer in Durham County Superior Court, became one of the more remarkable legal proceedings in North Carolina history. The courtroom was packed. Local media coverage was relentless. And a French documentary filmmaker named Jean-Xavier de Lestrade had been following the case since its earliest days with a camera crew, capturing footage that would eventually be broadcast around the world, and that would, in a twist no one anticipated at the time, become evidence in its own right more than a decade later. The prosecution's case rested on several pillars. Dr. Radish's testimony about the nature of Kathleen's wounds was central. A blood spatter expert, Dwayne Deaver, testified extensively about the patterns on the staircase walls, arguing that the distribution of blood was inconsistent with a fall and consistent with repeated blows. The Germany death was introduced to establish what prosecutors framed as a pattern of behavior, and the personal details, the financial pressures, the secret correspondence, the insurance policy, were woven through the narrative prosecutors presented to the jury as motive. The defense, led by attorney David Rudolph, contested every pillar. Rudolph argued that Kathleen Peterson had fallen, that she had consumed wine and had taken Valium, that she had perhaps suffered a medical episode, and that the blood evidence was the result of her body's movement in the aftermath of the fall, not of an assault. Expert witnesses called by the defense offered alternative interpretations of the blood patterns. The Germany death, Rudolph argued, was a distraction, an emotional manipulation designed to inflame a jury rather than illuminate what happened on Cedar Street. And he attacked the character evidence as irrelevant. A man's private life, however complicated, was not evidence that he had killed his wife. The jury deliberated. After more than 8 hours spread across 2 days, they returned a verdict of guilty, guilty of first-degree murder. In October 2003, Michael Peterson was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. He maintained his innocence. His legal team began the long work of appeal. What happened next unfolded over years, and it turned on a name that became, in true crime circles, almost as well known as Peterson's own, Dwayne Deaver. The SBI agent whose blood spatter testimony had been a cornerstone of the prosecution's case became the subject of an independent investigation into the practices of the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation. In 2010, a report commissioned by the state revealed significant problems with the SBI's forensic work across multiple cases. Evidence of potential misconduct and errors in how agents had presented findings in court. Deaver, specifically, was found to have misrepresented his credentials and his testing in the Peterson case and others. In 2011, Judge Orlando Hudson, the same judge who had presided over the original trial, granted Michael Peterson a new trial, ruling that Deaver had provided fraudulent testimony and that this false testimony had likely affected the jury's verdict. It was a dramatic reversal, and it put the entire case back on the table. Peterson was released on bail while awaiting retrial. He had spent 8 years in prison. The prospect of a second trial meant revisiting all of it, the blood evidence, the Germany death, the competing expert testimony. It also meant something else. By this point, the documentary footage shot by the Lestrade had been broadcast internationally, and a new generation of viewers had formed passionate and often polarized opinions about Peterson's guilt or innocence. The case had become cultural in the way that only certain cases managed to become, transcending its origins in a Durham courtroom to occupy a strange, contentious space in public conversation. The retrial was scheduled and rescheduled over several years. Witnesses aged, memories dimmed. The case grew more complicated with each passing month. And then, in February 2017, Michael Peterson made a decision. He entered an Alford plea to voluntary manslaughter. An Alford plea is a particular and somewhat unusual legal mechanism. It allows a defendant to accept a conviction and its consequences without admitting guilt, while acknowledging that the prosecution possesses sufficient evidence to obtain a conviction at trial. Michael Peterson, under the terms of his plea, did not say he killed Kathleen. What he said, in the formal legal sense, was that he understood a jury might find the evidence against him sufficient to convict, and that he was willing to accept a conviction for manslaughter rather than face the possibility of being convicted again of first-degree murder. He was sentenced to time served. He walked out of the Durham County Courthouse a convicted felon, convicted of voluntary manslaughter in the death of his wife Kathleen, and a free man simultaneously. It was, in its way, a profoundly ambiguous ending, neither fully exonerating nor fully condemning. The Alford plea satisfied the legal system's need for resolution without resolving, in any human sense, the central question that had animated 16 years of courtroom proceedings and documentary filmmaking and dinner table argument. The conviction stands. Michael Peterson is a convicted killer in the eyes of the law. He has never said he did it. David Rudolph called it a practical decision made by an aging man who did not wish to spend more years in legal limbo. Prosecutors in Durham, for their part, declined to characterize the outcome as anything other than a conviction, which it was. Kathleen Peterson's daughter Caitlin, who had stood by her stepfather for years before ultimately breaking with him and publicly expressing her belief in his guilt, did not speak extensively about the plea at the time. But in prior interviews and in her own recorded statements over the years, she had made clear that her mother deserved better than ambiguity, that Kathleen Peterson had deserved the full force of the law's attention and the full weight of its judgment. What is documented, what is adjudicated, what is beyond legal dispute at this point? Kathleen Peterson died violently on the night of December 9, 2001. She was 48 years old. Her death was ruled a homicide by the medical examiner. Her husband, Michael Peterson, pleaded guilty under the Alford mechanism to causing that death through voluntary manslaughter. He was convicted. That conviction has not been overturned. It is, as of this writing, the final word the law has spoken in this case. And yet the questions linger the way they so often do in cases where the evidence is circumstantial, where experts genuinely disagree, where a legal system designed to seek truth sometimes arrives instead at settlement. What happened on that staircase? What did those seven lacerations mean? Was Elizabeth Ratliff's death in Germany a terrible and eerie coincidence, or was it something a prosecutor's framing makes it appear to be? These questions will not be answered by any court, not now. The case is closed. What is not closed and perhaps never fully closes in cases like this one is the life that was lost. Kathleen Peterson was a daughter, a mother, a stepmother, a colleague, a friend. She had built her world with care and was, by every account, still building it. Whatever the precise truth of what happened after midnight on Cedar Street, and only one person knows that truth with certainty. The fact that Kathleen Peterson never had the chance to finish what she was building is the fact that ought to outlast every courtroom argument and every documentary frame and every word of narration. That is the loss at the center of all of this. It is worth remembering. That's three cases for today. From all of us at Intelligix, thank you for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.